Line three of the calendar, Ackermark versus Stockel. We'll hear first for counsel for appellant. Would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, Brock Alton, attorney for appellant, Mr. Stockel.
May I proceed?
Proceed. Thank you, Your Honors. In reviewing the cases this morning and getting ready to argue, it was apparent to me the issues in this case are relatively straightforward. And I don't think I will keep the court long. I don't want to repeat what is in my brief. So obviously we're here looking to reverse a district court decision, which itself reversed an order and recommendation, or excuse me, a recommendation for an order from a referee in a partition action.
And the referee's recommendation was?
That a specific amount of money, it's $58,000 and change, be paid from my client. He could stay in his home and pay $58,000 to the plaintiff in this case and respondent, Ms. Ackermark.
And instead, the district court set the compensation at a 50-50?
50-50, so the amount is not exactly known until all paperwork is submitted, a loan is issued, all costs are taken out, et cetera. That's right. At the end of the day, the dispute, or the two amounts, are probably going to be around $30,000 apart. It's not the biggest difference, but it makes a big difference to my client in terms of his ability, frankly, to get a new loan and make that payment. So it is of a lot of consequence, just because of his own financial circumstances, and that is why we are here today.
Didn't the district court reserve jurisdiction over this?
Well, Your Honor, there's reserving jurisdiction by statute. Every district court has the ability to look at a report of a referee and accept or decline it.
But your argument seems to be that there was an agreement as to the amount and that the district court didn't follow the agreement. Is that accurate?
Well, one of two arguments, Your Honor, I think this is what you're referencing, is that there was an agreement of counsel to abide by the decision of the referee, which was stated on the record at the time of the initial partition motion, which was only opposed in part. We weren't opposing the idea of partition, but rather the method of partition, because we were hoping that Mr. Stockel would be able to stay in his home. But there was an agreement on the record at that time that not only would we submit this matter for a recommendation to the court, but we would abide by that recommendation. That is correct. So one of my arguments is when the court later heard argument from us, excuse me, and Ms. Ackermark took the position that the report and recommendation should not be adopted, that was, in fact, in breach of an earlier stipulation in the case, yes. My primary argument, however, Your Honor, is that it was improper, and the district court hasn't provided any basis for the district court's decision to not accept the report and recommendation from the outset. And the case is really controlled by Newman versus Anderson. It's a decision out of this court, 916 Northwest 2nd 41. It's cited throughout the briefs, and it talks about the standard. So retaining jurisdiction is one thing, but the standard that you have to meet as a movant in order to have a court set aside a report and recommendation from a referee. And it states specifically and repeatedly that a referee's report should be viewed as akin to a jury verdict. And it should only be set aside if it is, the actual language, if it is shown by a clear and decided preponderance of evidence that the commissioners, it's an older case that's being cited, they use the word commissioner, not referee. The commissioners have made a grossly unequal allotment. There's nothing in the district court order that discusses our referee's report at all. There's no memorandum attached to the order.
Okay, so your argument is the district court erred by not giving appropriate deference to the referee's report.
Absolutely, and you do review that de novo. And that's exactly the issue that was in Newman. So if you look at Newman, the context is similar. There are differences. That's one of the items that I want to address for your honors. There are differences in the facts of the case, but the basics are the same. We have partition by set-off in both actions. You have a district court not following the report of the referees in both actions. And I am now challenging that and saying it's improper because the district court did not give due deference. Correct. And in Newman, this court did in fact overturn a district court for failing to do so. And it's actually a quite useful action or case for a number of reasons because it describes not just, you know, the deference to be given, but the process of partition actions to begin with. And it really lays out everything that this court needs to know about how to decide the case today. So the three things that I wanted to make sure to hit before submitting the case to your honors. First, we've had arguments about set-off a few times in this case, and if I'm reading respondent's brief, we're still arguing about whether or not set-off is a method of partition that can be used in this case, and if that's a misstatement, certainly respondent can clarify. But it is true that the Newman action involved a commercial farm. That doesn't mean that in private property or non-commercial settings, set-off isn't available. And the statute is very clear that any time a property cannot be divided and partitioned by kind because it would hurt everyone in terms of value, set-off is a possibility. And in this case, we essentially agreed to that. It's in Mr. Blake's report, that's the referee. You can see that counsel agreed on the day that we arrived. This is a lake house. It's a very narrow strip of land. It goes down a hill to the lake. You couldn't possibly divide this in kind. So somebody's going to keep the home or it's going to be sold. The way the referee's recommendation works is something I agree with, frankly. If my client can make the payment required, he should be permitted to stay in the home. If not, then partition by sale has to occur. So it's actually a two-part step. Partition by set-off, then partition by sale if my client fails to make payment. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing improper about that. And again, the parties essentially agreed to that. So to the extent there's any confusion about the use of set-off in this case, it is appropriate. The statute permits it, and the case is akin to Newman. Second, I referenced this a little bit earlier. It's true that the district court always, in every partition action, maintains the ability to reject a report and recommendation. That's all the statute says, though. The standard is set by case law, what I discussed earlier, the fact that it's akin to a jury verdict. So the second argument that I saw in their brief is, well, what does that mean? If we have to give such deference, how does a court effectively review reports and recommendations from referees? Well, the answer is case law tells you what needs to be found. And what finding has to be that something is manifestly wrong here. Now, the district court didn't bother to say why he went in a different direction than our referee. So it's actually somewhat difficult for me to try and understand that decision and tell you why the district court was wrong.
Let me ask you, and we review the district court's decision not to defer to the report of the recommendation of the referee de novo or for an abuse of discretion?
The review is de novo.
Mm.
And I can cite the case if it would be helpful to the court. It's Goldman versus Greenwood, 748 Northwest 2nd. It's a Supreme Court case from 2008. De novo review on partition actions. If there are factual issues underlying partition actions that you need to review, then you do use a clear and convincing standard, a clear error standard. But this isn't really about a factual dispute.
So we're just to substitute our judgment for that of the district court?
What you're supposed to do, Your Honor, and what the district court is supposed to do is defer to the judgment of the referee, the person in the best position to make the recommendation in the first place.
But then how are we to decide whether or not the district court inappropriately refused to defer to the referee? We would have to assess the referee's decision and decide for ourselves what should happen? That's
I think, Your Honor, it would be slightly different.
Okay.
You should review the district court's decision for any justification for why the district court essentially overturned a jury verdict. It's the same standard. And the district court didn't supply you with any reasons at all. And it's not my burden, it shouldn't be at the district court to say the referee did anything correct. The burden is on the movement to convince the district court that the referee did something wrong. Apparently that happened, but we don't have a finding from the referee that lets you know, the district court that lets you know, I think this is the mistake and here's why I am correcting it.
Would a remand be appropriate in this circumstance to say, would you please explain to us why you rejected this report? I'm thinking of cases in the child custody context, and I believe what the case law there says is, you know, you appoint a guardian to do a study and to make recommendations to the court regarding custody and parenting time. The district court, I believe, is not obligated to adopt the recommendations of the guardian ad litem, but if the district court does not do so, it must make findings explaining why it did not do so. So that seems analogous, right?
Certainly somewhat analogous, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I'm not a family law attorney, so I'm not as familiar with that line of cases. It sounds like maybe the statutes are a little more explicit. This is more common law driven, frankly. So there's nothing in a statute that says the district court must explain itself. But in a case like this,
we've said it.
Well, exactly. Well, actually, what you've done is overturn district courts. Newman overturns a district court. To your question, can you look at this de novo and just overturn it today?
Because
yes.
Because there was no explanation.
In Newman, they did have an explanation that the court found insufficient.
You said Goldman was the stand for we should follow?
I'm sorry, I misheard.
Goldman versus Greenwood, is that the case you were citing?
That is the case that I have in the brief, yes, for the standard on partition actions.
That's a child custody case.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, let me get back to the citation. That's 748 Northwest 2nd, 279?
Yeah.
I seem to have miscited the case then, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
But your argument essentially is, if you've got a decision from a referee, the district court is basically bound to approve it unless it gives reasons for not doing so.
Not only gives reasons, you need a reason. So just to do a step back further, you do have the referee's report in this case. It is single-spaced, 5 pages long, so 10 pages if it had been double-spaced. He considers closely the record. You can see his activities on the file, going to the bank, determining exactly how much is left on the loan. The referee did a very good job of coming to a resolution in this matter. When we went back to district court, I didn't ask the court, take this referee's number and make it lower in line with my previous argument. I defended that decision because Mr. Blake had clearly done a good job.
But didn't the report also recommend that the court should hold an evidentiary hearing and request that the court determine the ultimate payoff amount?
The portion that the referee recommended be held by hearing later was related to rents, which were not appealed to this court. So that would potentially change a payoff amount if rents were ordered, but Mr. Blake probably appropriately found that he couldn't resolve that issue outside of an evidentiary hearing, which was then later waived. Now again, there's no explanation in the order for why rents were not paid or not ordered in this case. I don't think it would be appropriate to dive into it too much, however, in this action. I did argue it, but I would stand on the briefs and the fact that, again, that was not appealed by a respondent.
If there's no explanation for it, aren't you asking us then to assume that the court's decision was based on the fact that it chose not to assess any rents?
I'm not sure I quite understand the question, but the district court's number differs from Mr. Blake's number, and if it was to... Oh, I see. So you're saying...
You don't know why.
That's correct. You don't know why.
So you're asking us to assume, though, that there was no thought on the district court's part about rents and whether they fit into this and so on and so forth when it determined that ultimate payoff amount.
I would rather the court not make any assumptions about the district court reasons, to be honest. They are not set forth, and you need something set up by the district court that tells you why a jury verdict, essentially, must be overturned. And we just don't have that.
If the standard is abuse of discretion, and that's pretty broad, how did the court err?
Well, Your Honor, that's the same explanation, and again, it goes back to Newman. The district court erred because it has not pointed to anything that was manifestly incorrect in Mr. Blake's report and recommendation.
You had a hearing on this, the party submitted briefs summaries?
Correct.
And then the court decided based on those summaries?
You'd be making assumptions, but yes, I assume you read our briefs, saw the arguments, and made a decision. But the decision is not one where the district court is sitting de novo over the referee. So in not following the referee's report, the district court needs a justification for doing so. And that is clear. And you don't have a justification provided by the district court, and I would suggest that there is no justification for not following the report. There's nothing in Mr. Blake's report that is improper at the level that would overturn something like a jury verdict, and that is the analogy in these cases. To the earlier question, which I never quite answered, if you were to remand for further findings, I don't think that would be inappropriate. And of course, we can re-argue at that time below. The judge in this case has moved counties, so I'm not sure how that would work. But that's just a side point.
All right, thank you.
You'll
have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you choose to use it.
I don't want to be hacking in front of you. So, yes, Your Honor. My name is Jerry Schulquist, and I represent the respondent in this matter. The issues before the court in the underlying matter concern the partition of a small residential lakefront lot that was co-owned by the parties, who cohabitated as a couple involved in an intimate relationship legally owned by them as co-tenants.
And we're familiar with the facts. Could you start with the standard of review that you think is applicable and give us your best case site for your proposition?
Well, if Your Honor would please indulge me for just a moment, because we disagree with most of what Mr. Alton is presenting here today, actually. First of all, there were two stipulations, not one. Appellant's arguments regarding the first stipulation to appoint the referee fall short in a few important ways. First of all, that the parties stipulated or agreed or contracted to the retaining of a referee, and the stipulations to retain that or appoint that referee were drafted by the parties, and the court actually signed both of those proposed orders. And those proposed orders say, this court retains jurisdiction over this matter and property. It says the court retains the authority to adopt the recommendation or reject the same. They say the court will ultimately retain the power to approve or adjust the equitable adjustments suggested by the referee. That's our agreement, okay? And so the parties stipulated to the appointment of the referee. The court made their stipulations the order of the court. By signing both of them, the referee was appointed and issued his recommendation or report. And that was, the terms of the first stipulation were fulfilled. That was it. Again, there was no stipulation between the parties at all that they would be required to abide by the recommendations of the referee. And on the contrary, the parties stipulated to allow the court to retain jurisdiction and ultimately use its decision-making authority. So then the parties did not agree with the recommendations of the referee, and the appellant contacted the court, and we had a hearing on that. And on the record, at that hearing, we made a second stipulation where we agreed that we would simultaneously brief the issues in the court. The court would, in lieu of an evidentiary hearing or trial, make a ruling, an ultimate ruling, in the case based on our briefs. Second stipulation was fulfilled. The court did that. Okay? So, and that is all the stipulating that was done. The issues before this court have very little to do with the specific nature of the underlying case, but rather concerns appellant's claim that the court and the respondent failed to abide by the stipulation to retain a referee in this partition, which is not true, and further, that the court failed to abide by the decision of the referee, which the parties, by their stipulations, chose not to do. So that is all the stipulating that was done. The terms of both stipulations were fulfilled, and so it is unclear to me why we're actually here today, because although I'm delighted to be here and equally part terrified, it's not clear.
Your argument is, regardless of what case law may say about the amount of deference which must be given to a referee in a partition action, the parties here agreed that even though there was going to be a referee, the district court ultimately would decide it based on equitable principles.
Yes, Your Honor. And the case of Newman, which the appellant relies so heavily on and was cited by the appellant, is easily distinguishable because the Newman case concerned the division of a family farm. that was inherited by the children, a commercial farm that was being farmed as a business by one of the siblings. And this case concerns a teensy little lakefront lot in Pine County where it was anything but commercial. Furthermore, the court in Newman reviewed and analyzed the merits of the referee's recommendations and even sent the recommendation back to the referees for further clarification. In this case, the court did no such thing. It did not review, it did not analyze the recommendations of, it was never an issue, actually. The only thing in this case that was before the court was the stipulations of the parties. The court spent no time whatsoever analyzing the recommendations of the referee.
Why then did we bother with a referee and recommendations?
Well, I think, Your Honor, because just like you said previously, in family law cases, and I think this is a very important case with regard to cohabitation, and I could go off into the weeds on that, being a family law attorney, but because referees and special magistrates and these sorts of persons that come into the court and on behalf of the court go out into the field and do the investigations and report back to the court, that duty or that chore, whatever, is very important to the court, right? But even guardian ad litems are required to be paraprofessionals. In the statute here, in the partition statute, which is in sad need of being updated, and there is a legislative proposal by the real estate attorneys that didn't make it to the session, this last session, but the case law is centuries old. And the referee, the statute says that two or three disinterested and judicious citizens of the county. So essentially, appellant is arguing that citizens of the county's decisions should have greater weight and authority.
But isn't that what the Supreme Court has said?
In that particular case, which is easily, I think, is very different. I think commercial real estate and residential real estate, especially in the cases of cohabitation, needs to be distinguished.
Well, and Newman, wasn't the issue that the court thought the referee had failed to consider the prejudice that would result from the referee's decision to one of the siblings?
Yes, the court, yes, and again, yes, the court analyzed, what were the issues, and was it fair, was it equitable, which is also number six kind of partition that the court under the statutes may consider, which is equity. The equitable circumstances, specific circumstances of the specific situation, specific case. So that is what the court did in that case. So the court did not overturn, in this case, the court did not overturn, did not reverse anything the referee did. In this case, the parties did. The parties did by stipulating following the referee's recommendation and report. They made a second stipulation and agreed on the record to abide by that stipulation.
And what was that stipulation?
That stipulation was to simultaneously brief the issues in the case and allow the court to make a ruling based on those briefs.
Without regard to the referee's report?
Without regard to the referee's, yes.
Okay, was that a written stipulation or it's on the record?
It's on the record, yes.
So your argument is the stipulation is binding on appellant. An appellant cannot now complain that the district court did not give due deference to the referee's report and recommendation.
That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. What can you tell us about this stipulation?
Thank you, Your Honor. That stipulation was quite limited. We went back to the district court after I did, in fact, provide the district court with the referee's report and an explanation that it was being challenged by a respondent and made a determination of how to proceed. This wasn't a determination that we give up all rights to argue that the referee's report is the proper method and the best way to move forward. It is, how are we going to handle this? We did letter briefs because there's economic difficulties, frankly, for both parties in this case, rather than holding evidentiary hearing. That's the only thing that was agreed upon at that point.
So your version is you agreed there wouldn't be a need for an evidentiary hearing, there would be simultaneous briefing, and from that briefing the court would make a decision what to do with the report of the referee, but the court was nonetheless still bound by case law requiring it to give great deference and, if not going to adopt it, to provide reasons why.
Correct. And, Your Honor, I'll just say, again, my letter brief, which would be part of the record, is all directed at the court should uphold this report. So obviously I didn't waive my right to make that argument, and the court didn't follow it. I wanted to quickly state, I just was reviewing the Newman case, trying to find if they had specifically stated standard of review. It'd be helpful to the court to be able to see that, obviously. They don't, unfortunately. You can read the case yourself. They're clearly not giving any different deference to the district court decision. It is de novo review, but they do not state that.
But they do point out some prejudice that would have come from the referee's recommendation as a reason to reject it, right?
I believe what they determine, this court, is that the district court failed to properly consider the referee's determination. And I want to just read what they actually did, reverse and remand the case. And here's what they say. The district court erred by setting aside and not confirming the referee's report. Therefore, we reverse the district court's August 17th, 2017 order and remand for the entry of an order adopting the referee's report and for further proceedings consistent with the referee's report.
Okay, so did I have it wrong? The district court failed to recognize that its failure to adopt the referee's report would have resulted in prejudice to one of the siblings.
Correct.
Okay.
That
so do we have that concern here, that the district court's failure to adopt the recommended payoff in the referee's report resulted in prejudice to your client, other than he didn't get as much?
Yes, Your Honor. First, the context in that case is that the district court actually made some findings, and so this court is reviewing those findings and saying we disagree with them. But second, yes, there would be prejudice to my client. He owes additional $30,000 to the other side. Now, of course, that in and of itself is significant. This isn't of record, but he also would not be able to produce that money and therefore be out of his home. So there's prejudice to my client, certainly. My point in reading what
was that argued to the district court as a reason to adopt the recommendations of the referee and not do anything else?
The last portion? Mm-hmm. No, and I did just acknowledge, Your Honor, that it would not be in the record. I was holding my own counsel on that, considering it's fairly personal.
So in district court, was respondent's counsel asking for half as opposed to what the referee had come up with?
Correct. Back to the sort of point at hand, while I was not able to find a de novo statement, I believe the decision of the court returning that matter, the Newman case, to the district court and specifically stating that it must proceed consistent with the referee's report, again, supports the fact that this is a de novo review. In any event, as you read that case, you'll see de novo review is what occurred.
I don't see any additional questions. Do you have any additional argument for us?
Nothing further.
Well, I thank you both. No one should be terrified to be here, by the way. We're quite harmless. We appreciate the briefing and the arguments and the matters under advisement. You'll have our decision within 90 days. And that concludes our calendar this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.